Welcome to In the Hive. I'm Roger McDonough. Today on the show, we're going back to a time before this. Before this.
You've got mail.
Before even this.
It was bright early one morning in December of, I think, probably 1969.
That's my mom, Ronnie McDonough.
And I was in the library at my desk at about 8:30 in the morning.
In those days, she worked as a librarian at a lab, a special lab, a new kind of lab.
I heard this giant cheer. I could hear noise. I could hear people gathering down the hall. But suddenly this giant cheer went up. All these people were cheering. So I, of course, had to go see what was going on. I stuck my head out the door, and there were all the programmers, the professors, the graduate students. They're all toasting each other with their coffee cups and their, you know, soda cans and whatever. And so I walked down and talked to one of the programmers, and I said, what's going on? And he said, well, our computer is talking to a computer in California. Now, my initial reaction to that was, well, big deal. Seems like they ought to be able to do that.
What my mom is recounting there is one of the early instances of the kind of communication we now associate with the full-fledged internet. And it happened here, 50 years ago, at the University of Utah. The lab my mom worked for as a librarian was called the Information Research Laboratory. It was funded by the Defense Department's Advanced Research Projects Agency, or ARPA, and it was run by a guy named Robert Taylor.
Robert Taylor.
Tom Harvey is a retired journalist who lives in Utah and Montana. 10 years ago, he wrote an article for the Salt Lake Tribune about the 40th anniversary of the birth of the network that would evolve into the internet. And I spoke with him on the eve of the 50th anniversary of that network.
Robert Taylor starts trying to sell this idea to different universities, and particularly, of course, ones that were getting research money from his agency.
His agency, again, that Defense Department group called ARPA.
But he told me he wasn't very successful at all of trying to sell them with this idea of networking all these computers together, you know, allowing researchers to share emails and chat with each other on through these computers.
Robert Taylor died in 2017, but Tom Harvey spoke with him, as I said, a decade ago.
But for the most part, he wasn't successful, but he did convince mostly universities on the West Coast to carry through with this idea to create the technologies that would carry this out. And there came to be four, what came to be called nodes of this ARPANET. And one was at UCLA, one was at the Stanford Research Institute, one was at UC Santa Barbara, and one was at the University of Utah.
And that's where my mom was in December of 1969 when Utah was connected to that network. Again, it was called ARPANET, and it has been hailed in recent decades for laying the groundwork necessary for the internet to come into being. But let's back up just a tad to events that set the stage for ARPANET to come into being, back to the Eisenhower administration.
So in 1957, the Soviets sent the satellite Sputnik into orbit around the Earth. And of course, this was the first orbiting satellite. And it shocked the United States, which had, you know, always thought of itself as a kind of a leader in technology and innovation and that type of thing, and enterprise. And so the U.S. responded in a couple of ways. One was to beef up funding for our own space program. And of course, 6 years later or so, President Kennedy was still pushing the program to land a person on the moon. But President Eisenhower, before that, created, because of Sputnik, created the Defense Advanced Research Project Agency, or ARPA. And he charged ARPA with gaining world leadership in scientific research.
The funding involved was pretty immense, and the leeway different researchers and research directors like Robert Taylor and other computer pioneers in Utah, like David Evans, were given to spend that money was significant.
And it's also interesting, especially with Bob Taylor, how it represents how a lot of this came about in science and probably why we won't see it again. I'm Lee Holler. I'm an emeritus professor of computer science from the University of Utah.
Professor Holler came to the University of Utah some years after ARPANET came into existence, but he specialized in networking, something that looms large over the next part of this story. Let's get back then to that funding model and how it let Robert Taylor, who started at ARPA and made his way to the University of Utah, to help expand on an idea already being worked on called packet switching, which paved the way for the networking the internet runs on.
Well, first of all, the way the government funded science was very different. You had a thing, especially in agencies like DARPA, but also in some of the operating agencies like Central Intelligence Agencies, where you had very strong contract. They weren't contract monitors. They were scientists. They had a direction. They saw the way they felt technology should go. And they went and found people who would do it. So today we would have, if we were trying to recreate it, there would be sort of a broad program and every university would submit fairly wishy-washy general proposals about networking, and it would be peer-reviewed with a panel at National Science Foundation, where here's Bob Taylor actually decides, and the story is there's the three terminals with people who has contracts with in his office, and he says, why three? Why can't this be one thing? Why can't they communicate? Why this nonsense? And he starts nosing around to see what sounds interesting, and he decides that packet switch communications, which was a real fringe idea, the phone companies weren't pushing it because there was no way to bill for it easily, because you couldn't keep track of all the individual packets. The overhead would be too high.
What does it mean, packet switch?
This is the idea of, instead of connecting up to a machine directly with a wire, we will have a number of machines on the wire, and we will divide the communications into segments, packets, and we will send them, and the appropriate machine will take it off the wire. And so it's a shared media. And that's the way all networking works now. But back then, it was a radical idea. And the phone company didn't like it because you couldn't bill for it easily. Because it wasn't how long your connection was up. Your connection was up all the time, but you might not be using it. And the idea is, during an idle time, other people are using it, and it's all dividing up. That's a fairly radical idea back then. It's the way everything is done now.
Holler says that aside from the funding structures in place and the fact that Robert Taylor and David Evans, who had established Defense Department inroads, were at the University of Utah, the school also had a burgeoning computer science reputation, especially when it came to the emerging field of computer graphics. And that was likely another reason Utah became the fourth node and the only node outside of California in what some people call the first internet.
So the original two that you hear about on the connection were really people, especially UCLA, that were heavily involved in networking research with promoting this idea of packet communications and so forth. Utah wasn't at that time. It has developed networking expertise, but at the time, Utah was not doing really anything in regard to networking. But it was a major ARPA contractor. And what it was doing is graphics under Dave Evans, and eventually Ivan Sutherland leaving ARPA and coming out here. Ivan is funding it because it's doing things that he had promoted in his original thesis about Sketchbook. And ARPA is, like ARPA does, is dumping a great deal of money into Utah.
Utah's reputation in computers, as Holler points out, was built on its being perhaps the location for graphics. Journalist Tom Harvey says that part of the idea behind the network that Utah joined so early on was to give other researchers a chance to access equipment they didn't otherwise have available to them.
The original idea was to promote something called, you know, time sharing for these computers so that you could log on remotely and use some time on those great big huge computers. You didn't have to be there in the room or in the city or at the university where these were located.
And Professor Holler says the use cutting-edge computer graphics hardware was, in a way, what made it appealing as the so-called fourth node on the internet.
Because they saw the interesting thing about graphics. And if we use graphics as an example, at the same time, I was at University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign getting my degree, one of the top schools in computer science in the world, had nothing comparable to the graphics equipment that had been built at Utah. Looked at NV, well, and the DARPA money putting it in. And so one of the interesting things with the ARPANET is that it would be a way for other ARPA investigators to send something out to be rendered on the equipment that Utah had, and they could send back a photograph. That's one project they're doing. There's another project related to graphics led by Tom Stockham. And Tom Stockham is the father of digital recording. And his interest was signal processing. How do we send a picture over a wire using as few bits as possible? How do we remove noise from a picture to make it better, especially if we have a series? All these things are really common now, but he's doing the foundational work. And he's attracted from MIT to come out here with, again, a bunch of ARPA contracts doing this. And part of the reason for Utah is that Utah has unique graphics hardware, has unique signal processing hardware for audio. Now, digital signal processing is in your control board, and all, but this is all nutsy, radical stuff tied into their computers. And so the ARPANET, after the original experimenters, is a way for ARPA contractors to get access to the specialized equipment that ARPA paid for.
And is it it's so weird, though, to think about, because you get access to the equipment, but are you really able to manipulate the equipment from afar using that initial
yes,
network?
Yes, because you could connect as if you were at a terminal connected to that machine. And you didn't have to, and at relatively high speeds. And you could move files back and forth. And these weren't heavily interactive machines anyway. So, yes, you could test out your rendering, and they could fax you back a picture or mail it to you.
According to current University of Utah computer science professor Mary Hall, what was happening at the university in the late 1960s in terms of computer research was very creative, artistic even.
So the whole program at University of Utah was about, they called it man-machine interface, and it was all about kind of creative, you know, uses of computers. And, you know, the graphics part is very famous, but if you go and you dig in the archives of the dissertations, there were things related to music, and, you know, there's just all this other kinds of stuff going on that was connected, and the computer architectures that you needed to be able to do that. And they were really looking out there at how somebody might use a computer, you know, way beyond anything that that anyone else was thinking about.
Just as a quick side note on the topic of creativity, Tom Stockham, the audio and signal processing researcher Lee Holler earlier called the father of digital audio, he was at the University of Utah at the time, and Holler told me that one of the reasons Stockham did what he did was because he loved the world-famous tenor Enrico Caruso, but he hated the recordings of him. Holler says Stockham's idea was to find a way of accounting for the recording device, Caruso had been recorded on a phonograph, to control for its shape and the impact that had on the quality of the recording. Para siempre, adiós, adiós, para siempre. Oh. Stockham eventually realized his dream of restoring some of Caruso's recordings, which were released in 1977 by RCA. It's worth pointing out that the heads of ARPANET were very dedicated to being an open source of information about what they were doing. They kept their research public. Their platform wasn't private. Nothing was hidden or obscured. And that allowed others to build on the work that was done at those early participating universities. And that allowed other similar networks to emerge and eventually necessitated a platform to unite them all, which became the real foundation for the internet as we know it today. Here's journalist Tom Harvey.
ARPANET showed that it was possible that you could connect these computers together, have them talk to each other, have people talk to each other through them. So it is definitely seen about as a precursor to the internet. Of course, you know, one of the people that I interviewed back then said, you know, it was nothing like the internet. It was slow. It was buggy. You know, it barely worked. And but it existed up until 1990. And that's when, you know, the internet really started to take off. The real internet really started to take off. And it kind of made the ARPANET too creaky and old and slow, and everything that was wrong with it, you know, showed through. And so it was shut down in 1990.
And U of U computer scientist Mary Hall.
I don't think anybody envisioned the kind of commercial applications and, you know, how everyone would have, be connected from their homes, from their phones. No one was envisioning that. But the idea was to connect researchers to each other.
Toward the end of our conversation, I asked Professor Lee Holler for his thoughts on the way the internet had ultimately developed after its initial start. We're in a world today where warfare is digital. I mean, it's almost more effective to be manipulating people through social media or whatever than it is to be dropping bombs.
Right.
I don't even know what question to ask you here, other than the fact that as somebody who was there for early networking or relatively early networking, and then sees what there is today in the internet, do you have observations about how things might have gone different, or do you lament the way things have gone?
I don't. It's kind of interesting because I think a lot of interesting things happened and it was open enough. What we've seen and what we see is the internet is just one facet of it. So we see the people, whether it's warfare, whether it's digital communications, for telemedicine, that putting in security. You find them saying, well, there's the internet protocol and it allows me to connect to things at random. And I don't have to, if I want to do telemedicine to Moab, Utah, I don't have to talk to the telephone company about running a private line. I can just mix in the same thing with a store and doing that. So I can get my connections very easily. Once I do it, I'll run it as what's called a virtual private network with encryption, with all sorts of things to protect it. So people can't get in on the network. And so on the internet, the whole body of it, there's the internet that we normally see. Normally with the World Wide Web is the primary thing, but there's other things on there too. Then there's the internet of all these private networks running on the same infrastructure because they can get connections easier, they can share facilities, they can lower costs. And then there is the dark net, which is again more an encrypted thing, a more private thing, but that's where the real evil lives.
You described to me the fact that they're all running on the same architecture.
They're running on because the architecture simply moves messages from one place to another over a shared medium. And so I can connect to it. I can say who I want to send it to. Everyone, whether it's these private networks and that aspect of the internet, whether it's the internet we normally see, whether it's the dark net, uses the same endpoint address, the same IP address, internet protocol address. And that tells how to get it there. And the network simply says, takes a message, says, send it to this endpoint. I don't know what it is. I don't care what it is. The network does its best to deliver it. And then each of them do their own things to build the model of communications that they want. The internet is a fairly open, semi-identified network. The dark net is one which tends not toward security, but to secrecy. We'll send the message through a number of different stations, so no one can easily trace it.
Right.
The private networks go for security. They don't. They know who they're talking to. They'll use fancy encryption in order to do that. Mm-hmm. And it becomes possible because as computers have become faster, we can run these encryption algorithms that essentially, because of their key length, are unbreakable.
But need the processing power to run them, basically.
Right. Okay. But now the processing power can be done on a microcomputer that you pay $10 for.
Which, if you're keeping track, is a long way from the four nodes of the original internet my mom witnessed being put together back in 1969. As we close in on the end of this show, it occurs to me that there are a lot of full-grown adults hearing this right now who don't remember a pre-internet world, who have no recollection of anything that came before all of this.
You've got mail.
The internet was one of those inventions that fundamentally changed the world, the way the automobile did, or the way the harnessing of electricity did before that. Sometimes, though, and I'm going to get a little wistful here, I miss the pre-internet era. Before election hacking and social media influencing and online advertising's terrible influence on journalism and personal privacy, before digital identity theft, phishing scams, and the threat that deep fake videos might pose in the near future. And I'm going to admit that I have a fantasy where a genie pops up with a switch that reads on, off. You decide. On, off. The internet. Forever. And sometimes I wonder if off wouldn't be better. But then my curiosity or musings or concerns about the people who don't remember the pre-internet world aren't all that special. They're not even new. I found a few articles in newspapers from the 1930s and 40s, not that long ago, bemoaning the fact that people were forgetting what the world was like before cars. They remembered that world. They missed it. And before I dig myself into too deep a hole, let me say that I know how absurd my genie fantasy is. I know how much of the global economy, how much of medicine, how much of everything is dependent upon the internet. It's perhaps the most powerful tool that humans have ever built. And it got its start here in Utah 50 years ago. So for those of you who do remember a pre-internet world, what do you miss about it? Send an email to comments@kcpw.org, and we'll try and include your responses in next week's show. In the Hive is a production of KCPW, a listener-supported independent public radio resource. Our regular theme music is by Andrew Shaw. What you're listening to now is also Sprach Zarathustra by the Brazilian keyboardist Eumir Deodato, from 1973. That does it for In the Hive today. Thanks for listening. I'm Roger McDonough. Please join us again next week.